This is the Pop Medic Podcast for March 23rd, 2016.
Bruce Wayne meets Clark Kent. I love it. I love bringing people together. How are we?
Lex.
Hi, hello. Lex, it is a pleasure. Ow, wow, that is a good grip. You should not pick a fight with this person.
This is the Pop Medic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I am Brian, and joining me today are...
Bill.
Captain Mike.
Jeremy.
I'm a new.
The new Batman vs. Superman comes out soon, so on this show, rivalries! Which doesn't make any sense, because Batman and Superman aren't rivals, are they?
They kind of are, commercially.
Yes. Kind of.
I mean, aren't they like...
You can't be friends until you butt heads and like have a mutual... You have to earn respect of each other.
Yeah, they have different philosophies in crime fighting that they need to work out through fists.
They're a yin and a yang.
That's some male... All right, okay. All right. They're going to be rivals in the new movie, so on this show, rivals... That's some comic book crap. Don't you guys get all nerd uppity on me. I jest... Regardless, today, rivalries, and you might notice that we sound a little different. We have been displaced, literally, by the Metro Police, who are in the Special Collection Center.
Whoa.
The Metro Police...
My eyes are still burning.
...are in the Special Collection Center today. We are literally recording in a closet, which we have joked about before, but we are actually...
Happening.
We are. Yeah. This is actually happening, because we... are awesome. We never say die.
That's right.
And...
Yeah, I'm like butted against a mop and the broom right now.
You literally may hear a toilet flush, and this may be the best podcast we've ever recorded. Okay. Mike.
It's the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's Mike. Right. You may remember... Last week, when I mentioned I tried reading books I didn't quite understand at a very young age. Well, that happened again several years later. Well, when I discovered the idea of alternate histories, I thought it was the coolest thing I had ever heard. I remember being about 11 or 12 years old, being so excited about Robert Adams' book of alternate worlds that I would carry it around with me everywhere, unread, for at least a month. Unfortunately, when I actually sat down to read it, I found I didn't actually know actual history, so this alternate stuff was really confusing. I'd eventually return to the idea of my teens with a passion. Ooh, it was very exciting. But more easy for me to grasp were alternate histories and comic books. Both of the big superhero publishers had their own brands. Marvel had What If, which took an event in regular Marvel continuity and asked, what if things went horribly wrong and everybody died? DC had Elseworlds, which usually reset a hero's origin story at another historical era. For instance, Gotham by Gaslight had a Victorian Batman, or an alternate, like, literary or artistic style, like Batman, the Doom that came to Gotham. I like the Batman ones. But today, I thought I would talk about one of the most popular Elseworlds ever, Superman Red Sun, which is written by Mark Miller and drawn by an assortment of dudes that I did not write down. When Superman's home planet of Krypton explodes, the tiny ship carrying baby Superman lands not in Metropolis, but in the heart of the Soviet Union. He grows up on a collective farm, where his abilities to do the work of an entire village alone eventually meets the attention of Stalin himself. Stalin grooms him into becoming the ultimate Soviet citizen. But meanwhile, in the United States, super scientist Lex Luthor simmers with resentment. For much in like the regular DC universe, he's jealous. And while he's the pinnacle of human achievement and brains and money and such, some alien comes along with super strength and hogs all the attention. Nah, you're just taking all the glory, man. And, you know, my hair. The American government recruits him to create an American Superman, which results in a crazy, bizarro abomination. Me fight for justice. Eventually, Stalin dies, and the Politburo nominates Superman to lead, hoping that he would be a dumb symbol while they secretly run things. But this goes poorly. And the Cold War begins to tip in the Soviet Union's favor. Ooh, Wonder Woman joins the USSR. Soldiers murder a young man's parents in front of him, and he eventually grows up to become a freedom fighter called the Batman. Complete with a furry Russian Ushanka hat with bat ears on it.
Awesome. I want one.
I still haven't read this book.
I giggled.
That's like the coolest thing.
Every time he appeared on, you know, it is me, you know, Bruce Wayneovich or whatever.
Borscht Man.
I wonder what people in Russia think about this stuff whenever they read it, but anyway.
Yeah, they probably get disgusted and whatever. The best kinds of Elseworlds to me play on the fundamentals of a hero's origin in fun and interesting ways. And at its most basic, Superman was always the story of an immigrant who treasures the values of his home country / planet, but chooses to embody the values of his new home. This is also the standard mantra of nerds who get bent out of shape when Superman turns evil. He had good parents! Midwestern values equals no killing! Meh, meh, meh. I don't care. Here, the idea is that what if the values of his new home are kind of evil? He straight up kills people. It's pretty interesting, at least until the final third, but I've talked too long.
Have you read Speeding Bullets, where Clark Kent is raised by Thomas and Martha Wayne, and
yes,
he sees them killed,
and
he becomes Batman with Superman's powers.
It is awesome until the end.
Oh, yeah. Spoiler alert!
Endings are hard.
Yeah, endings are the worst. Anyway, what do you have, Amanda?
Okay, so not since the Hundred Years' War between the English House of Plantagenet and the French Maison du Valois has a rivalry been as intense as that of the United States versus Russia / the former Soviet Union. Woo. Since the end of World War II, we've been competing against each other to build up more power, amass more weapons, and score more hockey goals. Do you believe in miracles?
I believe in miracles.
Thank you, that's pretty. So in order to make this happen, along the way, some spying has to have occurred. Sometimes it's uber-sophisticated James Bond-type people that get to infiltrate and then blow up Russian-type objects, but not Fabergé eggs, because those are really cool and everybody loves those. But other times, it falls to ordinary American citizens to serve their country. In his recent autobiographical book, How to Catch a Russian Spy, Naveed Jamali details his experience working as a double agent. Now, Jamali was born of a Pakistani father and a French mother, who both immigrated to this country in order to attend graduate school in New York City. And they ended up getting married, and after earning their respective degrees, they opened up shop doing research for people. And this is, you know, in the 70s, back before we had the internets. So it was hard then. Russians at the UN consulate in New York took note and began using Jamali's company to further their research into the American military. At first, they only requested what could be had in an open society. You know, we're the U.S., we like to share stuff. Jamalis would not try to get them anything classified, and they would get a big list, and then sometimes they would say yes, yes, no, yes, yeah, so. And the Russians just would, you know, take it and say thank you and go about their business. But when Naveed joined the family business, he wanted to push some boundaries. He'd always been interested in military and intelligence operations, and he had tried to join the Navy in their intelligence division, but he was turned down due to lack of experience. And so this opportunity, to spy on the Russians was just too good to pass up. The book was pretty good. It was mostly a cat and mouse game between Naveed and his Russian contact Oleg. And it's a little unclear, you know, what the payoff of this whole operation was. In all likelihood, Naveed was probably not completely in the FBI loop for security purposes. My only complaint was that at times it got a little bit, gee, look how awesome I am, as the book went on. You know, we get it, Naveed. You wrote the book. James Bond should take notes from you, etc. We get it. Okay, you're awesome. This is one interesting story in what I'm sure is a seemingly unlimited theater of conflict, and I'm pretty sure we'll never know the complete story of the level of spying between the U.S. and Russia, but I'm really glad it is not my job. Dear me.
So yesterday on the shuttle bus, I heard a lady talking to a guy. She said, you know my mom's crazy, right? Her mom is a lifelong registered Republican, but she dislikes Hillary Clinton so much that she registered as a Democrat so she could vote for Bernie Sanders in the Illinois presidential primary. So that's a pretty fierce, dislike of someone, I think. And her that woman's personal rivalry with Hillary Clinton is pretty caustic. But there's no rivalry more caustic than that between Marvel Comics and its distinguished competition, DC. There have always been other comics publishers like Gold Key, Charlton, and later Dark Horse and Image, but Marvel and DC have always been the mainstream Comics publishers, the giants, which cast shadows on all the other little guys. There's nothing wrong with liking them both, but
but you're wrong. One is great and one is okay.
Rivalry. Maybe that's true.
Yeah.
Maybe I should frame it that way. But every person who ever picks up a funny book as a young person must cast their lot with one or the other, and I'm here to tell you that I make mine Marvel. You cannot deny the usefulness of DC, as Mike so ably explained earlier. This is the company that ripped off two Jewish kids from Cleveland and gave us Superman, and there would probably maybe be no superhero genre without DC. Also, DC is the home of some of the most celebrated mainstream comics of the last 40 years. The Dark Knight Returns, Watchmen, and Sandman were all published under the DC or Vertigo banner, and Vertigo being DC's mature readers imprint, which was launched in the wake of Sandman's impact, and which also sort of became the home to some of the best comics of the last couple decades. So DC has history and prestige, but their characters live in a fictional world. In these places, they got Central City, Coast City, Star City, Gotham City, and Metropolis. It's generic geography. But having realistic comic books makes as much sense is having dry water or non-alcoholic beer. But in the early 1960s, realism was just what comics needed, and Marvel brought superheroes into the real world, which is a statement that makes me roll my eyes as much as it does fill me with wonder. It's hokey and even cliche now, but setting all their comics in New York City in the early 1960s was a stroke of genius. It allowed their expanding roster of characters to interact with one another, and it made non-New York City readers feel like they might see Spider-Man swinging around if they ever visited the Big Apple, which wasn't going to happen. Marvel also humanized their characters by giving them problems, which contradicted their superpowers. Spider-Man was famously neurotic. The Fantastic Four worked well as a team, but they were a bickering family. Daredevil was blind, and the Hulk had rage issues, etc. Now, all of this happened over 50 years ago, so it's not exactly cutting edge now, but it was revolutionary at the time, and obviously it's still paying dividends to this day. So for examples of Marvel's revolutionary approach, I think a good place to start would be the Marvel Masterworks Amazing Spider-Man Volume 1. This features the very first appearance of Spider-Man, as well as the first 10 issues of Amazing Spider-Man. Or, if you want to see Marvel and DC characters fight each other head-on, you can check out DC Marvel Crossover Classics 2 for all your Batman versus Punisher and Superman versus Silver Surfer needs. Bill?
Okay.
I could have helped, but I thought it'd be good for the podcast, but I didn't.
My co-worker and friend, Lou Hicks, and our many years of working together would exchange stories about things we had seen and witnessed over our years. Lou would often talk about this one heated exchange between two known intellectuals. On the left, Gore Vidal, American writer of novels, essays, screenplays, and plays, and on the right, William F. Buckley, Jr., an American conservative author, commentator, and founder of the National Review. This heated exchange took place on live television on ABC during the very tumultuous 1968 Democratic Convention. And oh, by the way, there was only three networks at the time. Well, to cut to the chase, in one of the debates, one of the more heated debates, Vidal called Buckley a crypto-Nazi. And Buckley, in snarling teeth, replied, "Now listen, you queer. Stop calling me a crypto-Nazi or I'll sock you in the GD face and you'll stay plastered." Now, these are two noted intellectuals and
on live television.
Yes. And Lou would always say, "It happened on live TV." And it wouldn't be made much of a... But then remember, this was 1968.
This is every night on TV.
Yeah, now. So it's Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So. I always thought, man, I wish I could see this. When is it going to be shown? Well, I did finally see it, and you can see it too in this fascinating documentary called The Best of Enemies, which takes a strong, hard look at Buckley and Vidal, the times in 1968, and how this one event changed the face of news and lowered its standards.
This is Miami Day One.
The
Republicans decided to hold their convention south of the Mason-Dixon line. And I blew that one. Let's go.
Pieces of the ceiling start flying, and then the whole thing started giving away.
To help us extract meaning from these conventions, two of America's most eloquent commentators, William Buckley and Gore Vidal.
Bill Buckley was the first modern conservative to see that ideological debates were cultural debates.
Mr. Buckley, do you think miniskirts are in good taste?
On you, I think they are.
The people at ABC asked him, well, is there anybody you wouldn't go on with? And he said, the only one I can think of is Gore Vidal.
Gore Vidal is one of America's most successful and distinguished writers.
We are all prostitutes in one sense or another, ethically, if not sexually.
For Buckley, Vidal was the devil.
I am a happy warrior. I'm in battle. I'm enjoying it.
He represented everything that was going to moral hell.
These were two visions of America clashing.
Each thought that the other was quite dangerous.
All this security makes me very nervous, because it's necessary, apparently.
If Buckley were not taken out, his ideas would take down the nation.
The country is being split at the seams.
It's almost as if they were matter and antimatter.
Say that again.
Freedom breeds inequality. Now I'll say it a third time.
No, yeah, twice is enough.
He's always to the right and almost always in the wrong.
I confess that anything complicated confuses Mr. Vidal.
A grotesque example.
He's nothing feigned. They really do despise one another.
Now listen, you're
the right of the
assembly. Stop calling me a crypto-Nazi.
Let's stop calling
I'll
names.
I'll slap you in your goddamn face, and you'll stay plastered.
This is William F. Buckley, Jr. in New York.
Perfect.
The Best of Enemies is great. It has a lot of archival footage, behind-the-scenes commentary, so I highly recommend The Best of Enemies. What started as a debate between two intellectuals ended in a World Wrestling Federation promotion. So I can't promote it enough.
Last year, it is great.
Yeah, I watched it on Netflix. They both had like such amazing jabs at each other, just like all these barbs.
They're clearly, there's no friendliness there.
Hated each other.
Yeah. It wasn't really a rivalry. Yeah. They hated each other.
What was really interesting too was like how Buckley was so shaken, like almost for the rest of his life after,
yes.
Because he like hated that he lost his composure that way. And there was something like there was a scene in the movie where they talk about, like, when he retired from his TV show or whatever, they showed that clip at this party or whatever, and he was just furious that they showed it, right?
Yeah.
Because he was like, I thought all those tapes were destroyed and stuff.
Like Vidal, like, kept a picture of, like, the debates in, like, his bathroom or something. For the rest of his life, just to gloat over, like, you know.
When Vidal didn't he write an article for Playboy or Esquire or something suggesting that Buckley was gay?
Yes, and then there was a libel suit.
Yeah, this is a great movie.
It's amazing.
But so. It also is disheartening, too, because you do see it as, like, the genesis.
Yeah, the start of today's
we have today.
You could argue, too, that it's really good for both their careers, right?
Oh, yeah.
Totally. We know who they are.
They both need each other, right? Everybody needs a nemesis, right?
Well, Superman needs Lex Luthor.
And also it happened on ABC, which ABC at the time was this fledgling network.
Set was collapsing.
And they said if you wanted to end the Vietnam War, said put the Vietnam War on ABC. It canceled in 13 weeks.
That was pretty amazing.
Yeah. Brian.
Okay, now for something completely different, but also happening in the 60s. Many people know that the band The Velvet Underground is maybe the most influential rock group ever. No indie rock, no punk, no experimental, non-academy music without The Velvet Underground. Now, The Velvet Underground was founded by two musicians, Lou Reed and John Cale. They were super hip. Their first band was actually called Falling Spikes, because they wrote songs about taking heroin. So they put out two records, The Velvet Underground and White Light, White Heat. And then Mr. Reed kicked John Cale out of the band, and they've been fighting with each other ever since. The Velvet Underground went on to make two more albums without John Cale that are regarded as classics. So, and then, of course, Lou Reed decided to quit the band an hour before a show. And he went on to record a number of solo records and become this great rock and roll celebrity. Reed himself is a very great poet. He's interested in crafting, you know, the perfect sort of 3-minute rock and roll song. He's really interested in the idea of like rock and roll as poetry. He's also very good with, you know, his delivery. And his phrasing. He knows how to bring out the sinister undertones in seemingly mundane lyrics. I think it's because he grew up in the 50s and this idea that like pop songs always were loaded with more content whenever there was more censorship, I think. So that everything was sort of coded. In the 70s, he releases a series of critically acclaimed, records like Transformer, Berlin, Rock and Roll Animal. His first solo record, Transformer, you have the classic song Perfect Day, which kind of demonstrates what I'm talking about.
Just a perfect day. Feed animals in the zoo. Then later, a movie too, and then home. Oh, it's such a perfect day. You just keep me hanging on. You just keep me hanging on.
You know, the way that he delivers his songs is kind of a little bit almost like the way William Shatner sings. But with William Shatner, it's obvious, but Lou Reed knows how to make it work. You know? Like
I don't know if I've ever heard that comparison, but that's pretty accurate.
I can see that. Yeah.
In the 80s, he kind of tones down his persona. Arguably, his records aren't as good. I think it depends who you talk to. His last record was Lulu, which he made with Metallica, which critics panned. Also, of course, throughout his career, he has a reputation for being maybe one of the biggest jerks in the history of rock and roll. Like, just completely mean and inappropriate and bullying to almost everyone in his life. How Laurie Anderson stayed married to him as long as he did, like, only she knows.
It was Tai Chi that kept him together.
Yeah, so that's just one of those things about Lou Reed that's out there, and it exists. You know, he liked to push buttons. If you took all the bad things about William Buckley and Gore Vidal, you might get Lou Reed's personality. All right. So what happened to John Cale, right? So, John Cale made a lot of solo records, too, after the Velvet Underground, but he came from a different place than Lou Reed. John Cale was classically trained. He studied at, what's that really famous musical conservatory in New England? Oh, yeah, that one.
Juilliard?
No.
Berkeley?
Cale won a scholarship to the Berkshire Music Center in Tanglewood, Massachusetts. But then, of course, you know, he was most interested in, like, avant-garde art music. This leads him to New York. He discovers drugs and rock and roll. So besides his solo music, he writes film scores and ballet scores and experimental drone music. Indeed, like, while the Velvet Underground was happening, a lot of members in that New York art scene were involved with the Theater of Eternal Music. And, you know, Cale kind of comes more from that direction than Lou Reed. Actually, it was said that Lou Reed kicked Cale out of the band because Cale wanted to keep pulling the Velvet Underground in a more experimental direction. And of those early experimental records of Cale's, you know, you have like Church of Anthrax, which he did with Terry Riley, or Academy in Peril. Arguably, these are the beginnings of sort of instrumental indie rock music. He also wrote a series of, you know, artsy pop music in the 70s. Paris 1919 and Fear. Here's a little clip from Ship of Fools from Fear.
The ship of fools is coming here. Take me off, I've got to eat. Same old stories, same old. There's a caravan parked on
worse is that even though he can, he's a tunesmith, he can't write lyrics as good as Lou Reed. I mean, Lou Reed is just a really great wordsmith. But Cale also has this legendary career as a producer himself. He produced some of the most early seminal punk rock records, so the first Stooges record, the first Patti Smith record, the first Modern Lovers record, which is the first, which introduced Jonathan Richman to the world that we've talked about before on the show. Now, which is better? I don't know. It depends who you ask. I gotta tell you, I like John Cale better. I don't care. He's Welsh. He's also into...
He had me at Welsh.
The Welsh connection.
He's also more into, you know, art music and absolute music, and especially in my youth, I cared about that far more. And the fact that Lou Reed is like just such a not nice person, that really made me like not care about his career. Now, they've came together for a few projects again over the years, and probably one of the best is Songs for Drella, which was released in 1987. This is their Andy Warhol tribute album, which they released after Warhol's death. Now, by all accounts, this record should stink. There should be no reason why these two aging rock stars coming together to do an in memoriam record about one of their famous friends. Like, this record should be garbage. This record is amazing. It will move you in many ways. It is an extremely heartfelt biography of Warhol, like a sort of, you know, rock opera about Warhol's life, and also Reed and Cale's memories of Warhol put together. It's really excellent. So Songs for Drella by Lou Reed and John Cale. Rivals can come together and make really good stuff sometimes.
Wow. Do you think, you had mentioned Lou Reed's drones a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think he did that partially to show Cale that he could be a figure quote serious musician too, or was it more Laurie Anderson's influence?
Both. I think there's both. You know, a lot of this early drone experimental stuff that they did in association with Lamont Young is out there, and we actually, the library has it on Hoopla. And Reed has always said that Metal Machine Music is a serious piece of music that he composed. He knows exactly what the oscillation is on the, that's coming out of the guitar amplifier, and what the overtones are and everything. And I definitely, it's because he was, you know, making that kind of music previously, to prove that he hadn't totally left that behind to just, you know, be a rock and roll star and make, you know, rock music and give really funny, hilarious, hostile interviews with the press.
He is on the cover of Metal Machine Music, though. You know, like, isn't he standing on the cover of it wearing, like, aviator shades, like, looking all cool in a leather jacket?
Yeah, I mean, that's like, half of his...
I know, but I just... Yeah, that's... I mean, maybe that's just to help sell it, I guess.
Yeah. So definitely, I mean, I think that's part of it. And then he also... I don't know when... I think at the time, I don't think he was married to Laurie Anderson when that came out at the time.
Yeah.
So, but...
What's the John Cale album where he's wearing the plastic mask over his...
Vintage Violence?
Okay, yeah.
This is awesome.
Yeah, I think I've got that one.
Like, indie pop record.
Yeah.
Which was his first solo record after Velvet Underground.
Okay.
Library has that. Hey guys.
Hey Brian.
Hey Brian.
Hey Brian.
What do we do on Tickle My Fancy?
Well.
Maybe the library has it.
Maybe the library doesn't. But either way, it's tickling our fancy. Amanda.
Me, yay! Okay, so it's still March. So this week, the March Weather Madness goes totally insane by mixing weather and wait for it. That's right.
Food.
Erotica.
Oh! Whoa.
Because who doesn't love a little sex with their weather, right?
Yeah.
So
I smell sex and
really, I hate that song.
It's really nice outside. Let's have a picnic.
Let's stay inside.
So I picked up Sidney Croft's Acro series, thinking that it was exactly what that... Weather and sex was exactly what I was getting. Now, ACRO stands for the Agency for Covert Rare Operatives, and the first book in the series is called Riding the Storm. It features...
Wait, what's it called?
Riding the Storm.
I was going to make a pun like that, but I thought it was too escape for the...
Beat you to it.
Oh, Jesus.
So it features Louisiana Bayou native and ex-Navy SEAL Remy Benyeau and parameteorologist agent... Hey, I want to be a parameteorologist.
Yeah,
okay,
so awesome.
We need to go into.
So you need to
like
read this.
This is like supernatural weather.
That's
yes.
So
you don't like the X Files? You gotta watch the X-Files.
I'm gonna have to watch the X-Files, the Galaxy Quest.
I watched Galaxy Quest. It was good.
I need to. It's on Netflix.
It really was good.
So anyway, so Remy has a love-hate relationship with storms, and when the weather gets bad, Remy can feel it, and he can direct its energy. Sexually?
Whoa.
Haley is sent to bring him into Acro before an evil and rival agency can get their hands on him and his power.
Hang on. Why does a spy agency need a guy who can channel his
Because you can
urges?
Send hurricanes at your enemies?
Yeah,
hello?
The weather. That's the ultimate weapon, Mike.
Seriously. Yeah, Mike.
Oh, you all your stupid little superheroes.
Yeah. I was seem to recall an X-Men named Storm.
Yeah. Mistress of the Elements.
That's right.
Really, you know, I missed
so,
that.
So this series contains seven books and two short stories. Another short story is rumored to be in the works, but from all the fan boards I found, it looks like the publishing date keeps being pushed back for like years now. So I don't know if they lost their deal or what, but so we're still waiting on that one. A little disappointingly, not every book is about weather. Sad face. The first one definitely is, and the third one, Seduced by the Storm, features a big hurricane in it. So that's exciting. These books are very heavy on the paranormal, lots of ghosts and telekinesis and things of that nature. It's a little darker than what I expected, but I would read the whole series for just the two with weather. Now, the good news is that when I started this series, they were ILL only. We didn't have them. But now I am happy to report that MPL has all of the full books in ebook form and Overdrive. And one of the short stories, the only one you might need me to help you with, is the first short story called Code Word Storm. But honestly, it's not really crucial to the storyline. So you can skip that one if you want. And if you like your va-va-voom with a little bit of thunder kaboom, you need to check out Sidney Croft's Acro series.
I'm just retiring after that.
You can't beat that.
Anyone can follow.
That's right.
I mean, there's...
just win right there. Mic drop.
Yeah, really. I dropped.
There's the, is it law, Rule 42 of the internet? Or is
I believe 43.
43. That's where it's like, if it exists, then there's porn of it. Mm-hmm. Like, really, this erotica series are like... Can just
pretty
do
much.
Anything.
I stopped
and it's not
being,
food.
So. Yeah.
I stopped being surprised after the erotic Tooth Fairy novel.
Jeez. Well, I
Says
mean,
the
we
man who talked about fluffy killer bunnies last week.
I mean,
that's not erotica, though. I'm not
we
talked
not
about
yet.
Bunnies.
Fan fiction.
There's Clippy. Ooh. There's Clippy erotica, as I mentioned on Amazon.
Oh, we don't need another tangent.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Are we talking about what's... am I next?
Yeah.
Sure.
Tickling my fancy this week is Starry Eyes, UK Pop Volume 2, 1978 to 1979. This is part of Rhino Records' DIY series. It was compilations. It was released way back in 1993. I used to have the New York volume, Blank Generation. I bought it on cassette at Big Lots when I was a freshman in high school. But I didn't get this volume until... I was a jaded old person with a mortgage and a child. This features great stuff like The Buzzcocks, Ever Fallen in Love with Someone You Shouldn't Have Fallen in Love With, The Undertones, Get Over You, and Joe Jackson's Is She Really Going Out With Him. But it also has other songs that aren't questions, like Bram Tchaikovsky's Girl of My Dreams. My favorite on the compilation probably is Squeeze's Up the Junction, because it turned me on to Squeeze, but also because my son, I played it for him, and he has done nothing but listen to the song over and over again since Saturday, and this morning he was trying to play a recorder along with it while he was getting dressed for school, and that always brings a smile to my face. We do not have this compilation on anything, but you can probably find it used somewhere, because that's what I did.
The library does have this song on a Squeeze Greatest Hits compilation called, wait for it, Up the Junction. That's on Hoopla.
Merrick.
All right, this is going to be fun, because I should look up a pronunciation guide for some of this, because I just read it, I don't have to say it out loud. This weekend, I finally got around to read the latest in Stephen Bruce's Vlad Taltosh series, Hawk, and I really liked it. So this is a high fantasy series about a human nobleman in a house called the Jereg, which is basically like a fantasy mafia. There's hitmen and assassinations and, you know, steal money from poor people, and it's great. The first few books, Eriks is a hitman for hire while running illegal operations in a small neighborhood of the capital of the mighty Dragarian Empire. But eventually, Taltosh angers the wrong people and goes on the run. And Hawk, he thinks that he may finally have a plan to get the Jereg off his back and finally settle down. Each book is structured kind of like the old Mission Impossible series. Taltosh never tells you his plans up front, and you kind of have to figure them out as the book goes along. You know, give me piecemeal and stuff, always dropping hints and such. If you're into fantasy world building like moi, there's a lot of stuff about the 17 great houses of the Dragarian Empire, the different species, this cool soul-destroying named weapons. You know, all that cool stuff. We do have Hawk, but I think he'd probably be confused. This is the 14th book in the series. It started 20 years ago, and he dropped a lot of stuff that even I don't remember. It's like, remember when you killed this guy? I'm like, no.
14 books.
So I would suggest starting with the Book of Jereg, which combines the first three books in the series. I'm going to have to email Brian how to spell that, which is on Overdrive.
Bill?
Tickling my fancy is a book called Dark Money, The Hidden History of Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right by Jane Mayer. Last year I talked about Missoula, about injustice of women who have been victims of rape on college campus, and this year I'm recommending a book in which billionaires use their influence over the American political system.
Another sunshine pick.
Debbie Dunn.
Bill's sunshine picks. That should be a patent.
Happy Bill's happy shiny corner.
We got to have a little meat there. The book mainly focuses on the Koch brothers, who are worth $90 billion. You heard it right, $90 billion. Mm-hmm. Who want to take America back to the Robin Baron era. If you read Dark Money, it's a great read, but prepare to grind your teeth at all the injustice of it all. It's appropriate to what's happening in the country right now. I don't want to mention any names. Trump, excuse me.
You need a Kleenex?
Brian.
Brian.
Hey, Brian.
Since this is an indulgent day, where we're going to break all the rules and talk about sex and politics, you probably should just probably usually.
Man, if I knew I could talk about sex and politics, I'd be talking about way different things, guys.
So, most war games or conflict simulation games are known for having really ugly art, really just mundane maps, just a big gray grid. There's nothing like like a Roman war game, and all it is like literally like a beige piece of paper with a hex grid on it. Like, wow, that's inspiring.
Use your imagination, kids.
Yeah. But things are slowly changing, and there are some artists out there now that are creating truly beautiful war game maps, and one of those artists is Terry Leeds. I first heard about Terry Leeds on a website. I was reading about a guy who built himself his own little wargaming, I don't want to say a table, because he mostly plays war games solo, because believe it or not, most people that play war games are lonely. But in his office, he built himself this very beautiful desk with like a glass top, and then the bottom was recessed, and he could put in most war game maps inside of it, and then he keeps the cat out, you know?
Is this the guy with the pipe?
No. And he's referring to the YouTuber named Callendale, not him. I could even link to it, because it's maybe I could find the article again. But he was playing this game that I'd never heard of before called the Battle of Monmouth. Now, Monmouth is Welsh, and I was like, what's that? But it's not the Welsh Battle of Monmouth.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, that's...
Hit it, history buff.
I'm only thinking of, like, the Duke of Monmouth, the pretender to the throne?
The Battle of Monmouth explores the fateful events of June 28, 1778, when the Continental Army, led by George Washington, heard of him, attacked Sir Charles Clinton's British and Hessian column. All right, so this is the American Revolutionary War battle, and I was looking at the map this guy had on. I mean, first of all, this desk this guy made was, like, really beautiful. It didn't look like a game table. It was, like, this awesome, like, piece of furniture. But the map was just beautiful for this little, like, small press war game. It was like, wow. Didn't really think about it. But then a bigger game came out called Liberty or Death, ironically about the same thing. In GMT's coin series, that's their counterinsurgency series. So this is about colonists, the British, native, and French forces. And you just four-player game. You all sort of play against each other, and you all have individual goals. It's called Liberty or Death. And the map for this game was, like, just fantastic. It was just this beautiful map with, like, shading and little trees and details. Basically the opposite of a beige grid. Terry Leeds' map for Liberty or Death. Amazing. Terry Leeds, an awesome artist of war games.
Awesome.
My most indulgent. Everything's awesome. My most indulgent tickle my fancy ever.
I have two minor corrections.
Give them to me.
The children's author's name, who I cannot pronounce, is John Cheska.
Cheska.
He writes things. Edward VIII abdicated to become the Duke of Windsor and not the Duke of Buckingham.
The Duke of Buckingham?
The Duke of Buckingham.
Wow.
The Buck of Duckingham.
I
the Uncle Buck.
I don't have a correction, but I wanted to say that the music that was playing in the Thunderbolt and Lightfoot trailer was amazing.
That's why I put it in. Because
awesome. Yeah.
Because actually...
It was so good.
I thought the clip was actually a little bit ambiguous, like what was actually going on, sure, just yeah. The dialogue. But that funk music yeah. was so cool. I was like, I gotta put that in.
That was okay. Mind-blowing. Loved it.
We'll try to find out who that is, and we can talk about the okay. show from 2 weeks ago
yeah,
next week.
Let's do it.
That's what we do.
Some addendums, clarifications. The clip at the beginning was the Ramones version of I Don't Want to Grow Up. You can find that on the Weird Tales of the Ramones box set. We mentioned Wayne White, local artist who worked on the amazing sets on Pee-wee's Playhouse. There's a whole movie about his work called Beauty is Embarrassing. We have it and get it from the library. Made a casual reference to William Shatner's performance of Rocket Man. That was on the 1978 Science Fiction Film Awards. That was the clip at the very end.
That was a secret Easter.
That was the clip at the very end. That's on YouTube. It's barf inducing.
I had to think about what it was for a minute. I was like, what is that?
Patrick Stewart never did that.
Man, you want to know something?
Life Force.
I remember watching that when it happened, and Bernie Taupin came out and introduced it.
That's yeah.
true.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The clip that I pulled that from, yeah, Bernie comes out and he introduces him. John Benjamin's jazz album is called Well, I Guess I Should Have Learned How to Play the Piano. For real, that's what it's called. The library cool. doesn't have that yet, but I'm sure we'll get it. For more information about John Benjamin and people that cannot play the piano, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
You can subscribe to the Popmatic Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or via
RSS feed.
Via ISIS.
Thank you, Michael, for the save. Next week.
College.
College.
Oh, go team. Rah,
go
rah, rah.
Team. And wait, what's like, I'm trying to, there's like some old school, like college alma mater song in my head that I'm almost ready to break into.
Gloriana Frangipana?
Yeah. Like that.
The spirit makes the master.
I know Rocky.
When you're growing up in a small town, when you're growing up in a small town, when you're growing up in a small town, you say, no one famous ever came from here. When you're growing up in a small town, and you're having a nervous breakdown, and you think that you'll never escape it, yourself or the place that you live. Where did Picasso come from? There's no Michelangelo coming from Pittsburgh.